All right. You are listening to KOWA LPFM in Olympia, Washington. And on the phone, we have J. Patrick O'Connor, who is the author of The Framing of Mumia Abu-Jamal. All right. Can you tell us about your book? In your book, you put forth a theory about Kenneth Freeman being the perpetrator of killing Officer Faulkner. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. Kenneth Freeman was the street vendor partner of Mumia's younger brother, Billy Cook. Kenneth Freeman and Billy Cook operated a vending site in Center City, Philadelphia, for a number of years, and they sold trinkets and novelties and that kind of thing. When they would get off work, at night, they would go out and have a few beers, that kind of thing, drive around. And this particular night was December the 9th, 1981, when Officer Faulkner, Daniel Faulkner, a Philadelphia policeman, working alone, pulled over the VW that Billy Cook was driving in Center City at 13th and Locust Street, in what's known as a red light district of Philadelphia. Billy and Kenneth Freeman got out of the car. The officer took a document from Freeman, a driver's application, on it and put it in his pocket. Freeman apparently got back in the car, and the officer talked to Billy Cook. Conversation turned ugly. Billy apparently struck the officer in the face. And then the officer began to subdue him by hitting him in the back of the head with an 18-inch flashlight, causing blood to flow down Billy's back of his head and for his knees to buckle. As it happened, Mumia, who was moonlighting as a taxi cab driver, was across this very narrow street in a parking lot waiting for his next fare when he saw his brother getting his head bashed in. So he ran to his brother's aid, and as he approached, Officer Faulkner, as he got right on top of him, Officer Faulkner shot Mumia in the chest, and Mumia collapsed at his feet on the ground. At this point, Kenneth Freeman, who was a U.S. Army veteran, a 25-year-old man, burly, 6 foot, 225 pounds, he gets out of the car, and when he does, Officer Faulkner grabs him by the shoulders. They wrestle. Freeman knocks Officer Faulkner to the ground on his hands and knees, backwards. So he's falling down with his back now to Freeman. When he gets on the ground, Freeman shoots him in the back, and then the officer rolls over onto his back, and Freeman shoots him in the forehead, right between the eyes, and apparently kills the officer instantly. Freeman then exits the scene, and the mummy is blacked out there, and within 2 minutes, police start arriving en masse at the scene, and they find Mumia, unconscious at the scene. And he's arrested and charged with the murder of Faulkner and put on trial the following year in late June of 1982 and convicted of first-degree murder in the death of Officer Faulkner and given a sentence of death by electric chair, and that was 26 plus years ago that occurred. So that's the basic outline of the case. Freeman ran away, and he got away with it. And, I'll just mention this. Four people at the scene said they saw one or more black men. Freeman is black. Billy Cook is black. Mumy is African-American himself. Four witnesses said they saw a black man, one or more black men running from the scene. And I mentioned earlier that in Faulkner's shirt pocket was this driver's application. It had the name of a man named Arnold Howard on it. So police went to Arnold Howard's house that morning before dawn. This occurred at, the shooting occurred around 4 o'clock in the morning. So before dawn, they roused Howard out of his house, bring him in for questioning, and he informs the police that he had given that driver's application to his friend, his longtime friend, Kenneth Freeman. Police then go and arrest Freeman and bring him in for questioning, but framing of Mumia Abu-Jamal had already been set in motion, and Freeman is subsequently let go. He didn't even have to hire an attorney at the police station. He just answered a few questions. They put him in several lineups where I was informed later that he was picked out of those lineups twice by a witness, but he was let go.
Can you tell us about the political history in the context of the case? Philadelphia at the time, the amount of corruption going on in the Philadelphia Police Department, and the general scene in the neighborhood.
At the time, there were at least 3 FBI probes going on investigating corruption within the Philadelphia Police Department. Even before that, in the mid-70s, when President Carter was in the White House, and Andrew Young was his ambassador, U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, they had a probe of the Justice Department. The U.S. Justice Department did a probe of police brutality toward black people in Philadelphia, and they had a very strong case. They took it to federal court, and the case was thrown out because they said the U.S. Justice Department didn't have standing to file suit against a city. Now, this was the first time in the history of the United States that the U.S. Justice Department had filed suit against a city's police department. And they named the mayor at the time, Frank Rizzo, in this suit for instilling this kind of anti-minority attitude in the police department. So the history of Philadelphia police is a very sorry one. The 3 FBI probes uncovered a massive extortion operation in among the Philadelphia Police Department, particularly in the 6th precinct where Officer Faulkner worked. Out of that precinct, which was run by the Central Division, 30 indictments came down, including indictments against the Deputy Police Commissioner and many other high-ranking Philadelphia police officers. The police officer at the scene who arrested Mumia was a inspector named Alfonso Giordano. He confronted Mumia in the paddy wagon that night, bashed his face in with a walkie-talkie, and rounded up a couple of witnesses to testify that they saw Mumia shoot Officer Faulkner. One was a 21-year-old prostitute by the name of Cynthia White, who had been arrested 38 times in the last 3 years on prostitution charges. And the other witness he got was a cab driver by the name of Robert Chilbert, 23 at the time. He was on felony probation for throwing a Molotov cocktail into a schoolyard during the school day. He was also driving a cab without a driver's license, which had been suspended for 2 DUIs, driving under the influence. So here was this felon violating his probation. Nothing ever happened to him or the prostitute. They became the star witnesses against Mumia at his trial. The prostitute would later say that she wasn't even there. She was there in the area, but had not seen a single thing that had happened that night. She, in an affidavit that a woman by the name of Yvette Williams filled out, she was a cellmate of Cynthia White's a few years later, and she said that Cynthia White said she testified against Mumia because she feared for her life, that the police made her do it, that type of thing. So the officer, Alfonso Giordano, to get back to him, you know, normally you'd have a detective at the scene. A homicide's committed of a police officer, there'd be a detective there. But Giordano, he takes over the scene and gets these two felons. Schobert's a felon. Cynthia White just is a prostitute with many, many arrests. He gets them to be the star witnesses. In that FBI probe we talked about, in 1986, this would be 4 years later, Giordano pleads guilty to extortion. He had been receiving $3,000 a month for an extended period of time from bar owners and pimps, prostitutes, etc., in the Center City area. And that explains his early arrival. I mean, he got there within 10 minutes of the shooting. There he's in full uniform. He's out making his collections, and then he stops and he comes over to the crime scene and sets the framing of Mumia in motion that night.
So why Mumia? What's the political significance?
Well, Mumia had joined the Black Panther Party at age 15. When the Philadelphia chapter formed in the mid-70s, like 1975 or something like that. And he was in it for 2 years until the Philly chapter disbanded. But he was started, there's a group in the Philadelphia Police Department called the Civil Defense Bureau, and it's an intelligence group, and they monitored Mumia from the time he was age 15 up until he was arrested for this crime. And the FBI also monitored him. He had a 900-page dossier at the FBI. They followed him everywhere he went and made reports on him. This Giordano was associated with the ongoing story in Philadelphia, you know, when I lived there, and was the biggest story on a daily basis, was the organization called MOVE, M-O-V-E. This was a counterculture group that was very anti-establishment and protested against all kinds of things, but among many other issues they protested was police brutality, and for good reason, because in 1978, the police raided the MOVE compound in Philadelphia and shot hundreds and hundreds of rounds of bullets into it, and all the MOVE members were in the basement. And then they turned on these water cannons and put thousands of gallons of water in the basement trying to flood them out, which they eventually succeeded in doing. They forced all the MOVE members out. None of them was killed. But during all these bullets flying around, one of the stakeout officers, Officer James Ramp, a single bullet hit him in the neck in a house across the street. A bullet hit him in the neck and killed him. So they put on trial, this was a very bizarre thing, of 9 MOVE members who were in the house at the time. Put all 9 of them on trial for the officer for the murder of James Ramp. And in the longest and most expensive trial in Philadelphia history, still to this day, trial lasted almost a year, cost over $1 million, they convicted all 9 MOVE members in 1979 and sentenced them to 30 to 100 years in penitentiary, state penitentiary. Now, that was 30 years ago, and that 30 years is up. and all, well, one of them died, a woman, Merle Africa. All the MOVE members used the last name Africa. So there's now eight MOVE members left from the MOVE 9. They are all still in prison, even though they came up for parole this year, this summer, in fact, and parole was turned down for all of them because none of them said they shot, nobody shot anybody down there, that the policeman was more than likely shot by, you know, a friendly fire. So they didn't, they say they didn't show remorse, so they left all eight of them are still in prison and looking at 100-year sentences. So Mumia now, at this time, 1979, he was employed. Mumia was a very prominent black reporter, radio reporter in Philadelphia at the time. He was named, in Philadelphia Magazine, they named him one of 81 people to watch in 1981 because of the type of reporting that he did. He was hired by the local public radio station there, which a lot of people might be familiar with because it's home to Terry Gross, who does the program called Fresh Air. That comes out of this same station. And Mumia, along with another NPR reporter named America Rodriguez, who subsequently went on to Los Angeles and worked for NPR for 10 years, America Rodriguez and Mumia did reports on this station jointly and separately. And one of Mumia's, one of the things that got Mumia driving as a taxicab driver was his coverage of the MOVE 9 trial was overtly sympathetic to MOVE, that it was absurd to convict 9 people. The authorities didn't know which one of them might have done the shooting, but they convicted all 9 of them for one bullet in the officer's neck that killed him. So Mumia covered that trial, and as he was covering it, the station manager decided that his coverage was not objective, quote unquote objective enough, and fired him. Now he was moonlighting as a cab driver on December 9th, 1981, and that's when this whole situation occurred. So Mumia's relationship to MOVE, in addition to his Black Panther Party association earlier in his life, when he was 15 and 16, that made him a marked man to the Philadelphia police. The police detested MOVE in a way that's kind of hard for people in any other city to understand. Maybe everybody would remember that in 1985, this hatred for MOVE reached its boiling point when the police dropped a firebomb on the roof of the MOVE townhouse in West Philadelphia and burned that house to the ground, and in the process burned down 60 other row houses, wiped out an entire city block in a black neighborhood of Philadelphia. So 61 row houses went down, and there were 13 MOVE people in this house at the time. 11 of them were killed by the fire, including MOVE founder John Africa and 5 children. Only one adult survived, Ramona Africa, whom I had the opportunity to meet when I was in New York a couple of weeks ago. She has these burns all over her body from this fire. And a young boy, he made it out. So 2 people out of 13 got out of this thing alive. And to show you how much the prosecutor's office and the police hated this MOVE group, I mean, they burned down their house and take a whole city block with it. They then put Ramona Africa on trial for conspiracy and convict her to prison for 7 years. This was in 1986. So she serves her 7 years. She could have gotten out much earlier if she would have disavowed MOVE, but she wouldn't do it. And so she got to serve the entire 7 years of her sentence. She's now out in the MOVE group, the MOVE organization, which is run by led by Pam Africa and Ramona, they've been the principal ones who have been with Mumia from the beginning in terms of, how did Mumia from death row get to be this worldwide figure who's got, who's an honorary citizen of Paris. They hadn't given out that honor since 1971 when they last gave it to Pablo Picasso. Now Mumia is an honorary citizen of Paris, so those are the last two, Mumia and Pablo Picasso. Mumia is an international figure because MOVE wouldn't let the case die. They started getting some of his essays published. The Yale Law Review published one of them. The Nation ran some of Mumia's writings. And MOVE just stuck with him all the way, and they're still fighting to this day to get Mumia out. So Mumia and MOVE they're joined at the hip, and as long as they are, a good portion of citizens of Philadelphia aren't too sympathetic to Mumia, because the city, a large part of the city, not the whole city, but a great majority of Philadelphians detest MOVE. They think they're crazy.
Can you tell us about the court proceedings and the issues of constitutional violations?
Well, Mumia has had my God, he's been in 26 years. He's had many, many appeals and lost them all. The first one of significance, it's just mind-boggling in terms of how unfair the justice system has treated him, occurred in 1989 when the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, in a unanimous decision, turned down his appeal based on the claim that the prosecutor, a guy named Joe McGill, prosecutor in the Philadelphia DA's office, that he used improper language in the summation to the jury at Mumia's trial when he told the jury, he will have appeal after appeal after appeal, so you, the jury, what you do here today may not be final. That kind of language minimizes a jury's sense of responsibility for its verdict. Kind of gets them off the hook. So this same prosecutor, in a case in 1986 that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court heard, a case called Baker versus the Commonwealth, they overturned Baker's sentence and ordered a new trial for the exact same reasons that McGill, the same prosecutor, in front of the same judge, Judge Albert Sable of the Common Pleas Court, McGill used the almost identical language at Baker's trial. So Baker got a new trial in 1986. He was convicted of, he had been convicted of murder. So Mumia comes along three years later, same claim, same prosecutor, same judge, same language, and this time they turn it down. So they call that the Mumia exception. Whatever, it applies to everybody but Mumia. The very next year, 1990, in a case called Beasley against the Commonwealth, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court made a ruling, a dictum, that it was improper and forbidden for the prosecutor in any future trials to reference the appeal process in his summation. So you had the Baker case, Baker gets a new trial, Mumia gets nothing, and then in 1990 they codified it and said no prosecutor in Pennsylvania can even reference the appeal process. So that was the first example, and that was at the state level. At the federal level, in federal district court, which is also located in Philadelphia, Mumia's habeas corpus appeal the ruling was handed down in 2001, and this same issue of the improper summation was denied, and all of his claims were denied, except the judge certified what they call a Batson claim. And briefly, a Batson claim occurs when the prosecutor is discriminatory against minority persons of the defendant's race. So in the case of Momia, who's African-American, if the prosecutor's discriminatory in the jury selection by removing otherwise qualified black jurors from sitting, that develops a Batson claim. In 1986, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a case called Batson versus Kentucky, ruled that it was unconstitutional for a prosecutor to remove jurors on a discriminatory basis because of their race. So that was 1986. That's been around 22 years. This judge, though, this federal district court judge named William Yawn, he doesn't grant Mumia a Batson claim, which means he would call the prosecutor in and ask him his reasons for why he removed. And at Mumia's trial, the prosecutor removed 10 or 11 black jurors, potential jurors, on what they call a peremptory basis, where the prosecutor is given, and the defense as well, each side's given 15 peremptory challenges, where they can take a juror off without having to give a reason. They just can take you off. They don't like the way you look, the way you part your hair, your attitude, whatever it is. Otherwise, they try to remove you for cause. If they can remove you for cause, let's say you're interviewed, you know, everybody gets interviewed. So the prosecutor's interviewing you and you say, well, I don't think Mumia did it. Then the prosecutors could say to the judge, I want this juror struck for cause because he's biased. And the judge would strike him for cause. But the jurors that McGill struck, they just happened to be black. He didn't have any cause. He couldn't get rid of them for cause. So that's what a Batson claim is all about. So Judge Yawn certified it, and that he should have granted it, but instead he just certified it. And this allowed Mumia's attorneys to appeal it to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, also headquartered in Philadelphia. And they took the case back in 2005. They sat on it for quite a while. Then they had oral arguments in March of 2007. And oral arguments, each side gets an hour to present their case. And I've listened to these oral arguments many, many times, and it looked very favorable to Mumia. By the way, the judges were asking questions. It's a three-judge panel of the Third Circuit. And the prosecutor, they beat him up pretty good. Not Joe McGill, a new prosecutor representing the Philadelphia DA's office. And it looked very positive for Mumia that he would get a new trial on the improper summation to the jury issue or on the Batson claim. But in May of this year, May of 2008, Third Circuit, in a very surprise ruling, and in a very controversial 2-1 vote, this three-judge panel split 2-1, they also denied all of Mumia's claims. And that was a stunner, because the reason they said they turned down his Batson claim was that the defendant, i.e. Mumia, his lawyers, did not know the entire racial makeup of the whole jury panel. You know, when you go to a murder trial, the jury pool could be 150 people, the pool. And from that pool, you're going to get 12 jurors. And in a murder case, a death penalty case, those 150 people, they weed out a bunch of them at the beginning when they ask them, do you have any objection to the death penalty? And any of those who say they do, they're excluded, and they're knocked off right away. It's called, death qualifying the jury. They have to be willing. They have to sit there and say, I'm willing to impose the death penalty. So takes care of 50, 60 people there. And a good many of those were more than likely black. Blacks are far less likely to go along with the death penalty than white jurors are, historically speaking. So you now have, question the Third Circuit hung up on was, since they didn't know the racial composition of that whole pool, that Momia, when he said that when his attorney said, well, the prosecutor used 10 peremptory charges against blacks, that's a rate of 66.7%, by the way. Their theory was, well, the jury pool, hell, it could have been 70% black or 60% black. So what the prosecutor was doing was average. But it's facetious on its face, that argument, because jury pools at the time in Philadelphia were picked from voter registration logs. And blacks historically have been underrepresented as voters. So more than likely, that jury pool would have been, at the most, 30% black. So to have a peremptory strike rate of 66.7 would have been way over double what would be normal. Nonetheless, they used that pretense, and they had to reach over backwards to come up with it, to say they're denying his Batson claim because Mumia didn't present the record of the jury pool. It's fairly odd. Now, what makes it so astounding for this court to do it is that in 2004, in a case called Holloway, same issues, large percentage of prosecutor, he struck, I think it was, of the 11 or 12 jury people he struck peremptorily, 10 or 11 of the 12 were black. So they said, well, they ordered a new trial for Holloway, and in that case, they didn't know the composition of the jury pool. They said it wasn't required to know. And then a year later, and this would be 2005, the case called, Grisham versus somebody. Same thing. The Third Circuit granted a new trial based on a Batson claim without knowing the composition, the racial composition of the jury pool. So here's the same court that in two previous cases, what we call precedents, and it's particularly a precedent if it's from your own court. You know, there's 12 U.S. courts of appeals. You might not take as seriously a ruling from the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco or the Eighth Circuit in St. Louis. You might not take those as seriously, but your own rulings, judges take very seriously. This binds this court. They're expected to respect and honor their own rulings. But they didn't. So they came up with this, really phony excuse that contradicted their own precedents on two occasions. So Momia's really gotten the shortest end of the shaft that you could imagine from our judicial system. His legal options are really running out as a result.
Can you tell us about the political figures that were involved in the case originally and that are still involved in this case?
The judge who arraigned Momia, and by the way, she did this at his hospital bed, couldn't wait for him to get, out of the hospital, recover from his wound, shackled to his hospital bed, chained to it. Judge Lynn Abraham came over to the hospital and arraigned him. She is now, and has been for over 20 years, the district attorney of the city of Philadelphia, Lynn Abraham. The district attorney at the time was Ed Rendell, who has been for the last few years the governor of Pennsylvania. One of the Supreme Court justices who's never recused himself from considering Mumia's case, his name Castile, Judge Castile, he was an assistant DA at the time of Mumia's trial. So three very important people who were involved in this case very at the very beginning are still in holding the levers of power, and they're powerful people with those levers.
So what legal options does Mumia have at this point in time?
He's got, you know, you can throw away the idea of a clemency by the governor of Pennsylvania, because that's Ed Rendell, who like the governor before him, Tom Ridge, ran on a platform of executing Mumia. I mean, that's part of their governor's campaign was they swore they would do anything they could to see that Mumia was executed. So unless some future governor of the state comes along with a different attitude, clemency is highly unlikely. He's got two remedies in the courts. One of them is to go back to that same Third Circuit. Since this was a three-judge decision, just a small panel of the court, asked the entire court to sit on bank, where all the active justices of that court would hold oral arguments again, and then act as a body to decide the case on its merits. The chances of that, they're fairly slim for a couple of reasons. This court has 12 active judges. See, the senior judges, they're not allowed to sit on bank, but they have the active judges. There's 12 of them. One of them is Governor Rendell's wife, Marjorie. She and two others, this is testimony to how politicized this case is. She and two other of the nine active judges have already recused themselves from this case. So one quarter of the court has already said, we will not touch this case with a 10-foot pole. That leaves nine judges. Five of those judges were appointed by the current president, George W. Bush, over the last 7 years. Obviously all Republican appointees. The two judges who voted against Mumia, they are Republican appointees. One of them was the Chief Judge Sirica, and since he wrote the decision, and the court's stacked with Republican appointees, I think it's going to, and the vote, by the way, to sit, for this Third Circuit to sit, it has to have a majority vote of the nine judges. So that of those nine, five would have to vote yes to sit. And since we know that Judge Sirica is not voting for it, and we know that George W. Bush has appointed five of them, that's six right there. So it looks very bleak for Mumia to get an on-bank hearing. However, since the Third Circuit went so obviously against its own precedents, very recent precedents in 2004 and 2005, that court just might say, hold the phone. This is too much. This is too, you know, this really makes the court look bad. It's too political. They might want to correct it. So you can always, people like me anyway, we can hope that they will see the light and do the right thing. I'm just not counting on it. Barring that, the only and final option is to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, Mumia's lawyers on three previous occasions have taken his case to the Supreme Court. And all three times, that court has refused to take up the case. But this time, considering the fact that this Third Circuit put new restrictions on a Supreme Court, a U.S. Supreme Court decision, the Batson decision, they've tampered with that. Many times I've seen when circuit courts of appeals or district courts, when they tamper with U.S. Supreme Court rulings by modifying them, restricting them, interpreting them, that the Supreme Court will say, slow down there. That's our job. We make these rules. Your job is to follow the rules we make, not rewrite them. So in the case of Mumia, the Third Circuit really did rewrite Batson. And it's kind of strange. I mean, I'll tell you why. This year, Judge Alito, a recent appointee to the Supreme Court, who, by the way, is from the same Third Circuit, he wrote the majority opinion in a case called Snyder that expanded Batson. Instead of restricting Batson, the Supreme Court in 2008, this term just concluded, it expanded Batson. It used to be that the defense had to show an inference of discrimination in the part of the prosecutor in the selection of the entire of the panel of the jury that sits. An inference, like maybe 3 or 4 or 5 times they could say, well, they could see a pattern of discrimination. In Snyder, the court greatly sharpened the Batson reach by saying the defense only needs to show an inference in one juror. So instead of having to figure out, well, he may have done it against 5 or 6 people, now if the defense can show discrimination in the part of selecting one juror, that hits the Batson standard, and a new trial would be ordered. So I think his best hope, and it would be quite simple for the Supreme Court, this wouldn't require a new decision on their part at all. All they would have to do is remand the case back to the district court that Judge Yon I talked about earlier, Federal District Court, not to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, but to the district court, and order that judge to hold a Batson hearing. And then if the defense could show an inference on terms of one juror, and I don't think that would be very difficult to do. Now I could tell you why if you're interested, but then Mumia, the Judge Yon, would be forced to, whether he liked it or not, order a new trial for Mumia, a new trial at the Common Pleas Court in Philadelphia.
What would be kind of the time frame for something like that to happen?
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court is on recess until October. Nothing's going to happen, certainly vis-a-vis that court, until late in 2008. And it takes them a while. They get hundreds of cases are thrown to them when they sit down in October. And they don't announce what they're doing for quite a while. I would think it'd be more realistic to project sometime in 2009, the U.S. Supreme Court, if it was going to intervene here, that would be the time frame, sometime in 2009. If the en banc, if the Third Circuit agreed to meet en banc, and that's a real long shot, they too go on recess, and that would be later this year. If they did, then this whole procedure of briefs, both sides would get to brief the case again, which would take effect. And the last time we did this, it took about a year or two for all the briefing to take place before the judges actually held the oral arguments. So if they agreed to meet en banc, I would think it wouldn't be 2009, 2010 even, before that would happen.
Is there anything else you'd like to talk about?
Well, I mean, this case, there's 3,600 people on death row in the United States. And Mumia, from the bleakest existence possible, I don't know how he's done it. But he's become this worldwide figure. He's overcome overcome the most incredible odds. He's published 6 books. He's writing another one right now. It's just an amazing story that this, he's now 53 years old. He went in when he was 27. That he's really defied anybody's expectations of what could be accomplished from death row. He does numerous radio commentaries over on prison radio. He's on Pacifica Radio. He's a major force. He's a major force for justice in his own way. So I think it's amazing what he's accomplished. And it's also amazing to me how much this system wants him suppressed. I mean, for the Pennsylvania Supreme Court to do what it did was, it was just unconscionable. For Judge Young not to give him a Batson hearing was unconscionable, in my opinion. And for the Third Circuit to invent this very thin, disingenuous pretense of not knowing the jury pool's racial composition was just way, over the top in preventing Mumia from getting justice. So I'm just astounded at the lengths to which the judicial system, which we all think is supposed to be fair, has been so unfair.
Well, thanks for joining us, Patrick O'Connor, author of The Framing of Mumia Abu-Jamal. And where can people go to get this book?
They can go online to Amazon or Borders or, Barnes & Noble. They should be able to go to any of those, Barnes & Noble or Borders bookstores to buy it in person.
Well, thanks for being on the air.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you.